there, Green Future Growers. Thanks for joining us today. If you're new to the show, I hope you'll subscribe on iTunes or your favorite Android app, and let's get growing.
Gotcha. I grew up on Long Island. Okay, I turn the recording on. I guess it tells people when you turn the recording on, just so you know, because, see, that's another thing. Like, it used to be really easy to turn the recorder on and off, and then I forget. Like, I would have forgot. I almost could have recorded a whole thing without forgetting. So I just turn it on right away now.
Okay.
And where's Hightown? It's so funny because yesterday I talked to a guy named Mark Highland, and you're in Hightstown.
Oh, it's Hightstown, yeah. Hightstown is right near Princeton, about 20 minutes from Princeton on the other side of Route 1, maybe about 20 minutes from Trenton. It's like right on the edge of Mercer and Monmouth counties, in Mercer County. Monmouth County is just, in fact, my farm is technically in two counties, which makes the whole property is anyway, the part I'm growing on isn't, but that makes the post office and the IRS kind of annoyed.
I was wondering that.
Yeah. We're in three towns and two counties. And
how big is your place?
So my great grandfather started accruing land during the New Deal in New Jersey, and my family currently owns 276 acres.
Holy!
And I am not growing on that much of it. I'm growing on about an acre, and I ultimately want to be growing on maybe 9 acres in total cultivation, 6 of which will be in production in any given year. That's about as much as I think one person can manage with 5 to 6 employees, and still like maintain some sanity. If you're doing if you're doing mixed annual vegetables, and you're not doing grain. I mean, in my ideal world, I'd be doing that of mixed annual vegetables and some additional acreage of like dry beans, which are a product that very few people are doing on the East Coast. There's a couple of like specialty suppliers of heirloom dry beans out in California, but there's very little done locally here. But that's a whole different beast. And it's something that I'm interested in like maybe breaking into at some point in the future, but not right now. My bailiwick is, like I said, mixed annual vegetables. That's what I know.
Excellent. All right. Well, I can't wait to get into the whole chat. So do you have a copy of the questions?
I do.
Okay, cool. Yeah, because my show keeps growing, and my husband and I just like banged out this course over my Christmas break, this garden course, and we've been working on a garden book for like, I don't know, a couple of years now. But
wow,
it takes a long time.
I'm sure.
So yeah, but it's kind of weird because it kind of all just, I don't know. I always tell people about like the blank page. I don't really understand the blank page. Like, why sit there and stare at a white piece of paper? Because I always have so many projects that are just sitting waiting for me to have some time. So if I don't have, if I can't hear it in my head for that or see it, because like I paint a lot, so I see things. Like if I don't see, have a vision for it and can't see it right then and there, why push myself? Just work on something else. And then at the right time that, like, I'm not going to be able to stop it. Like over Christmas break, it was like, cause I've been thinking about, we've been thinking about a course, and I actually bought the domain names last summer, and then like driving home one day from school, I don't know, something clicked, and all of a sudden I had the 12 lessons. Like by the time I got home, I couldn't even stop, and we just banged it out over Christmas break. And actually we only got through lesson 6. The other 6 will come in June, probably. Like it's designed to be one lesson a month, but yeah, anyway, enough about me. But so I always like to tell people in the beginning, I'm so out of funk with my podcast because I teach full time. So I do like to tell people in the beginning, it's really easy to edit. So if you need to get the cat, let the cat out or get a cup of coffee, or you want to think about an answer, you want to change an answer, like don't hesitate to put me on hold. And then do you have any questions? Like, have you done a lot of podcasts or anything? Do you listen to podcasts?
I listen to tons of podcasts. So when I'm working, especially this last season where it was just me, podcasts are what I listen to all day long. And even before that, when I was working at different apprenticeships, I'd listen to podcasts, you know, if we were hand weeding or something and we didn't have anything to talk about after, you know, 6 hours of hand weeding carrots. You know, we'd put on a podcast and listen to that. My interests range run the gamut from all the, like, you know, the good farming ones, like Farmer to Farmer is my favorite farming podcast.
With Chris Blanchard?
Cool. And actually one of the growers I was apprenticed to was recently interviewed, Scott Chasky, which was really cool. And so that's the main farming podcast I listen to. You know, I like Radiolab and This American Life, you know, the big ones. I also listen to a lot of, serialized fiction podcasts, Welcome to Night Vale and that whole like panoply of that whole like universe of, stories is really, really cool. HowStuffWorks.com puts out a lot of really good ones, Stuff You Missed in History Class, Part-Time Genius, Omnibus. Basically, you know, I'm never going to run out of podcasts. Although I am kind of proud and maybe a little ashamed to admit that I actually finished Radiolab this summer. So I've listened to every episode, which I didn't think was possible, because it goes back to the, early 2000s, and there are a couple in the late 1990s, but all the ones that are extant and online, I've listened to. But this is the first podcast that I've ever participated in. Never been in one before, which is kind of interesting, because like I said, I spend a good 10 hours of my day listening to podcasts.
All right. Well, by next year, you'll have your own.
Sweet.
And that would be a great one because you have a lot of experience to share. I'm sure people would love to hear different things. And you sound like you're a natural podcaster. So cool. Right. I love to listen to podcasts too. So welcome to the Organic Gardener podcast this morning. It's Monday, February 12th. It's a chilly day here in Montana. I guess it's like 19 below outside my window, it says. But I have someone in a bit of a warmer climate on the line from New Jersey, Gabe. I should have asked you, is it Siciliano?
Correct.
Gabe Siciliano from Abe's Acres. And I know you're going to love this because he's a fellow podcast listener. So I'm sure he knows how things like this go. And he sounds like he has an amazing story to tell us. So welcome to the show, Gabe.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'll tell you a little bit about myself and my farm. My name's Gabe Siciliano. I'm 26 years old, and I'm a mixed annual vegetable farmer in Hightstown, New Jersey. I use organic practices. I'm not certified yet. My farm's called Abe's Acres Farm after my great-grandfather, Abraham. He came to the United States in the late 1900s from Russia, fleeing the pogroms. And as a Jew in Russia, he wasn't allowed to own anything, let alone land. So his dream was always to be a landowner and to farm it. So he arrived in New York and then spent a couple of decades in Brooklyn, working at a grocery store, saving money. And when my grandmother and her sisters were born, during right about the time the New Deal started, he moved to New Jersey. Their government had a lot of subsidized programs for to make it very easy for people to acquire land, and had started all of these different agricultural products all down the Eastern Seaboard. So they moved to New Jersey, and he started acquiring land, and didn't know what he was doing farm-wise, and then just, you know, started farming and had kind of a decent go of it, not as successful as he would have liked to have been. And since I decided that I wanted to get into farming, I've decided to name my farm after him to sort of keep that dream alive.
Aw, that's awesome. And it sounds like you're another one of those rock star millennials I love. So good to know. The millennials I talk to are changing our world for the better and just doing amazing things like you are. Like, 26, and you said you have 6 employees and you're doing this place by yourself?
No. That's my ultimate goal. That's my ultimate goal. This was my last season, first season rather. I haven't, this last year was just me, on an acre. It was definitely a lot to bite off, more than I, definitely probably more than I could chew. You know, there's just a lot of tasks that go four times as long if you only have one pair of hands.
Yeah.
So
I found out about Abe because I just put up my episode. I did with Tom Neaton just last Monday, who has a business called First Vine. And we talked about organic grapes, and he was in New Jersey and stopped at some restaurant, he was telling me, and bought produce from your little stand. So tell us about, well, all right, I guess I should go back. I always start my show asking about your first gardening experience. Like, okay. I guess, did you grow up on your grandpa? Is that where you grew up with your parents or like?
Yeah. So I grew up the next town over in West Windsor, and I spent a lot of time, almost most weekends, with my grandfather, Joe, on their farm. And basically, as soon as I could walk, I was out with him in the garden. And he was an avid gardener, both of vegetables and flowers. And, you know, in his semi-retirement, that's what he did, was he managed this, you know, this beautiful property. And I was always outside with him. And that was my first gardening experience. Most of my childhood was spent with him tending his plants.
And did he grow organically? Like, is that how you learned, or is it a different learning curve, or?
Well, so in terms of organic growing, he didn't think of it that way. That was just how he grew up growing things. Just using, you know, good sound organic principles. He wasn't, you know, quite familiar with the paradigm. If you'd asked him, he would have said, well, I don't really know anything about organic growing. This is just what I do. But, you know, looking back, all his methods were organic. In terms of growing on a production scale, organic, my first apprenticeship was, I did a couple of apprenticeships, the first of which was at Quail Hill Farm in Amagansett, New York, on the east end of Long Island. It's a pick-your-own CSA with like about 150 members, I think. I learned a lot from the farm director, Scott Chassie, who was actually one of the earliest proponents of community-supported agriculture. Quail Hill was one of the first CSAs in the country. And then I went... You know, my goal was always to, you know, farm on, you know, my family's property down in New Jersey. So I moved back to New Jersey and started an apprenticeship with a woman named Jess Niederer at Chickadee Creek Farm in Pennington, New Jersey. These two places, I really learned, learned my craft and learned what it takes to grow on a production scale using organic methods, which is a lot harder than the equivalent of conventional growing.
So did you learn some tricks and tips working for these other people that you want to share with us? Because like my husband and I, like, so he grew, like dug up what I call the mini farm last year. It's like a quarter of an acre to a third of an acre. And we are definitely struggling with the curve from, you know, backyard gardener to market farmer. Like his big goal has always been to grow all of our food, at least as much of our produce as we possibly can. And like, I can't even imagine expanding because like what he grew this year was huge, but it's still barely enough for the two of us. Like I can't even imagine how people get to that production point.
So to that end, I would say there's a few things that separate, you know, small scale gardening for oneself versus growing for a profit for market. The biggest of which is time management and efficiency. You know, time is money, and every moment that both hands aren't occupied with a task is money that you're losing. So you have to fit farmers make all their money depending upon what zone you're in. You know, I get 8 to 9 months out of the year. You get fewer for sure. What zone are you in? Zone five, zone four?
I think we're 4B or 5.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're zone 7, and we get, you know, much longer growing season, but, you know, all the money needs to be made in that part of the year. You know, you can do season extension stuff and high tunnels and whatnot, but that's, you know, just given the limitations of photosynthesis, if there's not that much light, there's not much growth. So time management and efficiency, developing ways of doing tasks faster, and wasting less time is of the utmost importance. Like even in my day-to-day life, I'll constantly be looking for things that things that take less time. Like how, like I'll think about how many times I'm picking up and putting down a particular tool, like minimizing that. The other thing is getting a standardized system for growth in terms of bed spacing and walkways that's fitted to the tools that you have available. So I use JM Fortier's 30-inch beds with 18-inch walkways, and that's specifically geared towards a walk-behind tractor called a BCS that allows you to do the whole bed that way. Any given farm that you'll go to, the bed spacing is based on the tools that they use. I would also say having a really, really good integrated pest management strategy in place to manage pests and disease. For organic growers, a lot of pest management comes down to pest exclusion barriers, which are very useful on a larger scale, but incredibly useful for the home gardener as well. So pest exclusion fabrics, things like Reme and Agribon and ProtectNet, are these fabrics that that you put over rows of crops suspended on wire hoops. And what they do is they physically exclude pests from getting in. So they're permeable to air and water and sun, but impermeable to insects. So they're put up over these hoops and they're pinned down using sandbags, and they keep pests out. It's kind of tricky because if you don't get the tension exactly right, or you leave gaps between the Reme and the ground, pests can get underneath. But this is how I'd say, for example, summer squash and winter squash. We have a pretty noxious pest out here called the squash beetle, and there's another one called the vine borer that just burrows into the bottom of the plant. In order to keep those pests off of the plants until they start flowering, you put Reme over them, and that keeps out all the insects. And once they flower, of course, you have to take the barrier off so they can be pollinated, because otherwise they won't fruit. But pest management becomes very, very important once you start growing larger amounts of one particular thing. Because if you have a couple of squash plants, you may or may not get an infestation of squash beetles. But if you're growing 200 row feet of squash plants, then you're almost surely going to attract pests.
Awesome. There was a lot there. You just keep going. My listeners are always like, don't interrupt people. Well, do you want to tell us about something that grew well this year?
Sure. My most prolific crop was definitely sweet peppers, which is great because peppers are my favorite vegetable, not necessarily to grow, but to eat. I had really fantastic yields, and the fruit was of exceptionally high quality with very little pest or disease pressure, which was kind of exciting. I trialed a whole bunch of different varieties. My favorite that I grew this year was an F1 hybrid called Revolution. And I got that seed from, I think, Fedco. It grew really, really well. The season this year wasn't quite as hot as last year, because once temperatures go above, I think, 95 degrees or so, pepper plants start dropping their blossoms without setting fruit. So it stayed very close to that temperature for, a few brief spells, but it never really went past that. And it was just an overall really, really great season for peppers, which is exciting, on a piece of land that I've never grown on before. And it's, under its first year of organic management.
That's interesting, because I had always assumed peppers really like the heat, but they like the heat up until 95 degrees, huh?
They do. They really like the heat. But past a certain point, they'll just drop blossoms.
And maybe they like it more after they have their fruit growing, right? Because sweet peppers, are those like red and purple and yellow and orange ones, or are they green, or like?
Yeah. So all sweet peppers start out as green when they're unripe, and then depending upon the variety, they'll ripen to to different colors. Some peppers will ripen straight to red. Some peppers will ripen to purple and then to a reddish color. Some will just go straight to yellow, straight to orange. Chocolate peppers will ripen to a brown color that will then sort of get brownish red, which is why, incidentally, sweet peppers, colored sweet peppers are always more expensive in the grocery store and farmers markets than green ones. They've been on the plants longer and require more inputs and field care in order to get them, ripe. So they cost more.
Can I ask you a question about chocolate peppers? Just out of curiosity, do they call them that just because they're brown, or do they actually like have a chocolate flavor? Like, I've never even eaten one. I don't know why.
Oh no! They don't taste anything like chocolate. They just have a very. They just look. They have a very chocolatey color.
Yeah, I've seen them. They just have a.
Yeah, they're delicious. They're not an incredibly high yielding plant. But it's a really early variety of pepper. It's one of those things that looks a little bit different. So sometimes it's not super popular at farmers markets. Like you said, you look at it, you wonder like, does that taste like chocolate? What does that taste like? But they're really, really delicious. Really nice flavor. Oh. Very sweet.
How about something new or different you're excited to try next year?
I'm going to be doing a lot more root crops for winter storage. In particular, I'm trialing a bunch of different types of carrots to see what does well in my soil. That's one of the ways that market gardeners and farmers can, extend their profits through the off season is growing a lot of stuff and storing it. So a lot of root crops like, rutabaga, turnips, carrots, beets, kohlrabi, technically not a root, but still stored like a root. Radishes, that sort of thing, as well as cabbage. These are things that can be stored in cool storage and then sold throughout the winter. So that keeps that keeps you in touch with your customer base and keeps a cash flow going through the seasons where stuff isn't growing as much. I had hoped this season to be able to put up a high tunnel, but I don't know if that's in the cards. And that if I'd done that, then I wouldn't have been able to grow green throughout the winter, but I don't think it is to be this year.
Where do you market? Like, I know he said you had that stint. Like, where are you going to sell carrots in the winter? Like, do you have them at a grocery store, or do you have like a CSA, or how do you reach your customers?
So this first season, I primarily supplied restaurants because it was easier to make my budget work if I knew exactly how much I was going to be selling. So I'd, worked out how much I'd be selling per week to particular restaurants ahead of time. And I had one market stand at one of the restaurants that I was working with, which was right on like a major roadway. So it was pretty successful. And I, I wasn't
selling. How often did you go there? Like once a week or?
Yep, once a week. I was there once a week, and I also I also supply produce to a local health food store one town over. I'd really like in the future to be doing more farmers markets and less work with restaurants. Maybe work with one or two restaurants and grow specialty crops for some chefs because I really enjoy doing that. But my bread and butter is really. Is working at farmers markets. I love selling produce myself. I love talking about the product. I love, talking to people about what it takes to grow something. Cause a lot of people are very divorced from, food production and don't really understand what it takes to get the food to the grocery store shelf where they're eating it. They don't understand that a lot of the vegetables that they're eating and a lot of the fruits have been harvested by human hands, not by machine. And that there's a lot of effort that goes into growing food. And I think that when people know a bit more about what it takes to grow their food, they can make better, more conscious food choices as consumers. So to that end, I'm, you know, applying to a bunch of different markets this season and hoping to get into one or two of them, and do two markets a week is my goal, as well. And, you know, keep supplying a couple of the restaurants that I was worked with last season.
So much there. So how did you, was it like working at those other, like doing your apprenticeships that made you reach out to restaurants first? And like, what did those conversations go like? Cause like, I want to start like interviewing chefs that to find out, like, how do those conversations go? Like, how do you approach, cause I think I would be nervous to like go to a chef and be like, do you want to, and I don't know, that's kind of dumb, but.
No, it's not dumb at all. It's really kind of nerve wracking because you're putting yourself on the line saying, hey, do you, you're saying like, hey, do you think I'm worth, doing business with? And the rejection sucks. But if they're interested, chefs are, those conversations usually go something like, you know, sitting down, talking to the chef, seeing what they use, on a week to week basis and asking how much of it they use. For example, you know, in the height of summer, a restaurant is going to be using a lot of tomatoes, but not necessarily that many herbs. So you might, you know, sell a couple of bunches of basil to a restaurant per week, but you're not going to be selling enough to make it worth your while. So some places are really interested in just, you know, basic crops, and some places are interested in specialty stuff that's difficult to find elsewhere unless you have someone grow it for you. For example, if you're familiar, there's a green called mash or corn salad that's really delicious. It has sort of a buttery, silky texture, but it's very hard to find in stores or from food purveyors, because it's not very popular in the United States, although it is very popular in Europe. And I grew that for a chef in Hightstown, who was very, very excited about it. So it usually boils down to figuring out what they need on a weekly basis and planning how much you plant and your expected yields around those numbers.
Nice. I ate that when I was in Paris. You see it more and more in the stores these days, like especially in like those mixed spring mixes and things that you can buy.
Yeah, it's in a lot of mixes, but it's very hard to get on its own.
Yeah, that's very true. Is it hard to grow?
It was a challenge. There was not very much information out there about growing it, at least not in English. And not on a, not on, you know, any kind of production scale. So that was a bit of a challenge. But otherwise, you know, it likes cooler temperatures. It's a bookend crop. It grows well, better in the fall than the spring, I think, or at least that's the success that I had with it. It's harvested very much like any other cut green, although you can only get like one or two cuttings out of it. So management of successions is pretty crucial in order to continuously have like a good supply. But it's not that hard. And it's something that especially if you haven't had it before, it's something that's really cool to try just because it's got a very unique flavor.
Got any tips for managing successions? Cause that's definitely one of my weaknesses. Like, I don't know. Like I keep thinking what I need to do is like, take the seed packet, separate the seeds, put them like in an envelope and be like, I'm going to plant these on this day. I'm going to plant these on this day. And like, you know, so once a week, they're all laid out already. Don't go out there with a whole packet of seeds because I'm going to put that whole packet in the ground.
Yeah. I would say planning is absolutely essential. Any farmer is going to have a crop plan done before they start the season, and that crop plan and the dates for planting are, of course, you know, not set in stone, because you know, not only because of the weather, but because there's so many things going on in a farm or in a garden at any given time that you may not be able to get to it when you want to. But having a good template for when you want to get successions in and when certain things are getting seeded, you know, for transplant is absolutely essential for not only, you know, a smooth operation, but to make sure that you have the right supply of things at the right times. So, you know, I'd be doing a seeding of beets once every month or so, for example, once the season starts. But yeah, just winging it is not really a good idea. It may be kind of hard if you've never done it before to sit down and make that plan ahead of time. But once you have, you'll be thanking yourself later all throughout the season because you'll have a document to refer back to. Even if you need to make changes or, you know, modify what days you're doing what, being able to work from a template is very, very good.
Awesome. Well, so that's interesting because I came up with my first book for Black Friday, and it's called the 2018 Garden Journal and Data Keeper. And it has places for you to keep, like, actually what I put in it more was like for harvesting, like what food do you buy at the grocery store? What are you spending your money on? But also like, what did you harvest from your garden? But it's all based on that, like keeping track of things. So I guess I need to put more planning type of, I mean, it's actually, we came up with a garden goals challenge and like all those kind of things. So I think this is going to be a good episode for listeners if they, and the garden goals challenge was very like down, people were really downloading that. So how about telling us about something that didn't work so well this season? Is there something that you were disappointed in or didn't come out the way you thought it would?
Absolutely. Well, more than I would like to admit, to be honest, but I would say the thing that had the, which is always the case on any farm, like there's going to be a lot of stuff that doesn't go the way you want to. It's just the nature of the business and the nature of growing things in general. But my biggest problem that I think affected me the most was how wet and cold of a spring we had. It snowed very soon before I wanted to start doing my primary tillage in the spring. And this, keep in mind, had been was going to be the first year I was growing on this particular piece of land. So I had done no tillage whatsoever. And, you know, as I'm sure you and, you know, many of your listeners know, it's a really bad idea to till cold or wet soil. When you till wet soil, you destroy the soil structure, and you're setting yourself up for failure in the long run. So it was wet. It snowed in like early March, and then that snow melted over the, and it stayed cold. So it melted over the course of the next 3 weeks. It stayed wet throughout the whole like month of March and up into early April. So I couldn't get in the ground and do very much bed preparation. And due to the fact that, you know, it was just me, you know, planning and trying to handle everything at the farm, I wasn't able to get all of my bed preparation done on the 3 or 4 days in early to mid April when it was dry enough to do so. So I missed out on a couple of early successions, and that kind of tripped me up in the beginning, and I felt the reverberations of that through the rest of the season. So this year I'm really planning on being on top of my tilling schedule. And if I need to stay out, you know, for 14 hours and get all of it done on one day and then put it under silage tarps, then so be it. But I don't want to have to say, well, I can't do anything today because, you know, there was no tillage done and the soil is, you know, too wet to till.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. That's a tough attitude, or maybe you're going to have to bite the bullet and get somebody to help you for that one day or something. Get some temporary labor. I don't know if that's a possibility. Have you thought about like having like any interns or anything? Cause you seem to have a lot of knowledge that somebody might be interested, or like those woofer people.
Yeah. I actually have, I'm talking to a local high school's agricultural program now to see if they've got, any interns who want to get work experience on a small scale organic farm. And I'm hoping that works out, because I can't pay anybody, right now. I just don't have the money to do it. That would just make things so much easier for me because, you know, hand weeding is such a long time consuming chore, and it'd be kind of cool to talk to people and, like, you know, teach people about this sort of thing. I'm also talking to a few people about becoming a business partner and sharing equity in the business. Cause like I said, some people I know could maybe do this on their own, but it's really quite a lot to handle. And just one other set of hands would make things go so much faster. So I'm talking to some folks right now about that, and hopefully that works out too.
Yeah. How do do you balance, like, to me, another one of the hard parts is, like, balancing between being the farmer and doing all the work on the farm and then being the salesperson at the market and going to market?
Yeah, that's a big deal. I spent quite a lot of my time this last year, you know, making deliveries and, you know, going out to restaurants. And because it was just me and there was no one to take care of stuff in the field, you know, I'd have to make a choice between, okay, you know, do I make these deliveries or do I let some field work, you know, slide for a couple of days? And if, you know, having another set of hands and having someone else to work with would make that decision a lot less difficult. It was definitely something I had trouble with this past season.
So do you do like a lot of reaching out during, like, at this time of year, during the winter?
Oh yeah, this is the time of year that I'm sitting down with chefs and planning, you know, what I'm, you know, talking to them about what they need during the season, like, you know, when they'll need it, how much of it they'll need. Like I said, this all goes back to planning, like really good, effective planning ahead of time. These are the kind of conversations that are difficult to have during a season, and you really want to get your foot in the door with a chef. And, you know, be their primary supplier rather than jump in and say, hey, is there any chance, you know, you could use, you know, this extra 120 pounds of tomatoes that I have this week? And getting a firm commitment ahead of time and, like, working out a plan not only allows me to, you know, kind of count on making that money, but allows me to plan how much I'm going to be growing and harvesting, or at least, you know, plan how much I would like to, you know, grow and harvest and yield.
This is awesome. What about, can I ask a question about, like, has anybody, like, because I brought some herbs and stuff into this restaurant I was working at, and they wouldn't use them because they were like, you're not, like, an official farm or anything like that. Like, has anybody asked you any of those, that, or just because maybe you are an official farm, but, like, we're like, did anybody ask you about, you know, you're not coming from Spokane produce, you know, all of our produce pretty much comes from Spokane produce in Montana. And so I just, gotcha, curious, like, has anybody said anything like that?
No, they haven't. And I don't know if that's just, if that's because it's just different where you are in terms of, like, where you're getting most of your produce, but there's no, like, you know, there's no one who's saying you're an official farm and you're not. You know what, you can get a farm certificate from your local extension office if you're growing on 5 acres or more, but I'm not doing that yet, so I can't get a certificate. That's unusual. Most of the chefs that I've worked with are, like, super, if you've got something that they're interested in, they're really psyched about it. No matter how small an operation you've got going, or, you know, how little or how much something you're growing. You know, I know a lot of people who go out and forage wild mushrooms. You know, that's a big thing on the East Coast. And, you know, chefs will buy those from people, just, you know, come in and say, like, hey, I found a 25-pound, you know, chicken of the woods. Do you want this? And the chefs will say, yeah, sure, absolutely. If you've got it and it's something I can't get somewhere else, you know, here, I'll pay you for it. You know, chefs are, you know, as long as they don't have any suspicions about the cleanliness of your product, or, like, you know, the food safety of your product, then chefs are usually really excited to be getting stuff from people that they can't get elsewhere.
I know. Well, I was just shocked. I was like, geez, it's just oregano and basil, but it will really improve the taste of your food. Yeah. But yep, they wouldn't use it. So I was surprised, but I don't know.
I've never had anyone say that.
So this is the part of the show where we get to the root of the things, and it's kind of like more like a lightning round. And gotcha. So which activity is your least favorite activity to do in the garden? Is it weeding, or is it something you have to force yourself to go do?
Oh, yeah. I hate hand weeding carrot seedlings when they've just germinated. It's tedious. It's exacting. And if there's a lot of grass in your bed, it's easy to confuse the carrots with germinating grasses, because when carrot seedlings germinate and don't have their true leaves yet, they look just like little grasses. It's just so tedious.
I completely understand. I felt like I went to the seed fair, and what they were doing at the seed fair that I thought would really work was they had like these strips of newspaper and they made this like flour and water paste, and they were like spacing the carrot seeds out like an inch apart so that it was almost like they were doing it beforehand. So you didn't have to do that. But on a large scale, I don't know that that would work.
Yeah,
it might be an invention for you to come up with down the line.
Well, that'd be kind of cool. There's actually something kind of like that. It's called paper pot transplanter, and it uses uses these paper strips to transplant into the ground. You just push it along a row. Unfortunately, it's not because of some of like the components of the paper itself. It's not certified for organic use yet. Most growers will use seeding machines like the Earthway seeder to space seeds out ahead of time, but you still have to thin and hand weed once the seeds have germinated. Because carrots take so long to germinate, the weeds grow so much faster than, so you have to kind of stay on top of it until the carrots get big enough that they can shade out, you know, weeds.
I hear ya. Carrots are definitely one of my toughest ones. I like to get the grandkids out, but like I said, as we go into that market scale, it's definitely a challenge. So on the flip side, what's your favorite activity to do in the garden?
Harvesting in general, and in particular, I like harvesting garlic scapes. Garlic scape harvesting is really, really satisfying. They make, especially if you're growing a lot of garlic, they make, if you pull the scape properly, it makes a really nice, satisfying popping noise. They're such a delicious seasonal treat that it's just exciting when they all come on at the same time, you know, early June.
What do you do with those?
Oh, garlic scapes are great. You'll see them on a lot of menus now in higher end restaurants. You can do a number of things with them. You can make pesto, which is unbelievably delicious. The flavor of a garlic scape is, you know, very garlicky, but not pungent and harsh, like, you know, a raw bulb of garlic would be. But my favorite way to prepare them is just to grill them on the grill outside with a little bit of olive oil and salt and pepper. And they retain that sort of garlicky flavor, but they get kind of sweet, and they're delicious. And like I said, they're only around for a few weeks in June, so that you got to get them while you can.
That's interesting. Actually, the first person who told me about garlic scapes was this guy, Joe the Mason, up in Maine. And I just had him back on for my anniversary, January 29th. So good to know for listeners. They'll like that. What's the best gardening advice you've ever received, or best farming advice you've ever received, Keaton?
Always keep very, very meticulous records. You may think you're going to remember how long it took something to germinate, or how quickly something flowered and fruited, or how much you harvested. And you'll say, yeah, I remember this. This is totally something that I'm going to remember in, you know, 4 to 6 months. And that's never the case. You're not going to remember what day it was. You're not going to remember how much. A lot of things are going to fall by the wayside. You'll forget a thing or two. And keeping really meticulous records is a good way to plan for the next season. Like I was talking about earlier, it all comes down to good planning. It's really, really helpful to keep track of what works and what doesn't. I could not tell you, especially once it gets like super busy in the middle of the season, I couldn't tell you what I was doing on July 15th of last season if I didn't have a notebook to look back to.
That was my next question. Where are you keeping track? Do you do it online, like with an app, or you have like a physical notebook you're using?
So I use some agricultural crop management software. It's called AgSquared. But most of the farmers I know use Excel for crop data, and have like a notebook or field log that they keep track of their daily tasks in. The program I use can import and export from Excel. So it's pretty powerful. It does require a yearly subscription, but if you've got a copy of Excel, there's some pretty good information out there on how you can use Excel to help keep track of stuff and also plan for crop yields and for field planning. You can set up a spreadsheet to show you how many seeds you're going to need for like, you know, given, you know, bed, for given like, you know, space of row feet and when you should plant them and all that. It's really, really cool.
Have you read Richard Wiswell's The Organic Gardener Business Handbook? Have you seen that book?
I am familiar with it, yes.
Because he has, I think it comes with a CD, and it's got like all those charts laid out, which is really nice.
Yeah, that is really cool.
How about a favorite tool that you like to use? Like if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without?
So I do a lot of hand hoeing, and my absolute favorite tool is the DeWitt Diamond Hoe with a pistol grip. It's really, really sharp. And you can move it in any direction and it'll cultivate. And it's got this little grip on the end of it that allows you to really get leverage in there, like to get through tough roots. When you're hand hoeing, like, you know, 500 row feet of crops, and you're doing it, you know, for, you know, 6 or 7 hours a day. It's, you know, having the proper tool really, really matters. And I really couldn't live without that one. It's not a cheap piece of equipment, but it is a really useful piece of equipment.
Cool. So is the garlic scapes your favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden, or is there something else you were thinking of?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would say so. You know, I like to keep things simple and let the flavor of peak season produce shine on its own merits. So grilling fresh vegetables is, you know, just what I do during the season while I can. And grilled garlic scapes are probably my favorite of the vegetables that I can grill. But you can grill anything, eggplant, peppers, tomatoes, onions. You know, it all works.
Nice. How about a favorite internet resource? Is there somewhere you go on the web to get information?
Yeah, a lot of different places. But one really, really good centralized resource, Johnny's Selected Seeds, has a fantastic growers library. It's free to access on their website and has a lot of information about germination times and expected yields for things. It's really, really easy to get to. If you just go to the Johnny's website on the toolbar right at the top, you just click Growers Library, and it's really easy to search. It's really easy to use. They got a lot of great info.
They do. I love their videos. And I like it. The other thing is nice. They're pretty short. They put a lot, yes. They pack a lot in a short amount of time. How about a favorite reading material, like a book or a magazine or a blog that you can recommend?
So my favorite gardening book is The Market Gardener by Jean-Martin Fortier. And I'd say my second favorite is The New Organic Grower by Elliot Coleman. And those are like two really, really popular books for small scale market gardeners and people who are looking to break into it as a business. They're really, really useful.
Absolutely. We have both of those. I was thinking we should have like a library, like a garden library, I don't know, episode, or like
absolutely.
I should write a podcast about, or like I should have like a blog post about the 10 books you should, I think I even started one once. We have both of those books, and Mike like poured through the Jean-Martin Fortier one the day he got it. Like I've never seen him go through a book, and he still thinks about it. Like there was this pond water system in there that he's been like ruminating on for 3 years, and he finally like something clicked for him this winter, and he's like so excited to get out there. He's like, I finally figured out how it's gonna work. So we're excited about cool. that, because water's definitely been an issue. And like we even dug this deep well a few years ago, and it's still, I like, that's the other thing, I can't imagine us ever having enough water. Like we ran out of water. We have two wells. We have a shallow well and a deep well. We ran out of water at least once a week every week last summer, either in the house or out in the garden, and we're just constantly having water shortages. And so he really wants to build that pond to have a backup for irrigation. And so it's like a holding pond, and we don't have to worry about that. So I don't know. Well, not that you haven't dropped like a zillion tons of business advice and things for market farmers, but do you have anything for people, like, I don't know, how to get started? Like, I love that you apprenticed places. And did you always know you wanted to do this?
No, I didn't always know I wanted to do this. In fact, I only really got into, you know, I've always liked growing stuff, but I didn't know this is what I really wanted to do until a few years ago. But if you're really interested in going into business, yeah, that would be my best advice. Work, like, apprentice yourself to, or work for someone who's already established, and just learn the business from the inside out. You know, learning by doing has always been the best for me, may not be the best for everybody. You know, I know a couple of people who have just, you know, read everything they could get their hands on and then started a farm. But if you really want to know whether or not it's even something that you can do, in terms of the amount of work and the amount of time that you need to spend in order to make it profitable, you should apprentice yourself to somebody or work for somebody, even if it's just not necessarily working in the field, but you know, doing a farmer's market for someone in season, getting, you know, some sales experience.
I was just going to say that. Because I think a lot of people like have this dreamy idea of what it's going to be like, but the practical approach of like, and also like, maybe you really like being out in that farm, but you don't want to have anything to do with the business piece. And, you know, right, there's a lot, you know, it doesn't matter how many vegetables you grow, if you have no place to sell them, I mean, there's going to be pieces that you're going to have to do. And so working for somebody and checking it out is awesome. Yeah. And when I interviewed Jean-Martin Fortier, I remember talking to him and being like, I don't think I will ever have what it takes, the energy and the time that they spend to run a garden. But then after teaching, I was laughing. I'm like, oh my gosh, look at all the work I do teaching. So I think just as long as you're passionate about it and you love it, you will find a way. But you do have to think, oh, sure, there's a lot of pieces to it besides just being out there and harvesting on a sunny day. There's going to be a lot of chores that you're going to have to do, a lot of work, and then the whole marketing piece, dealing with the public, unless you have somebody, like you said, that can do those pieces for you, or you can, you know, partner up with somebody, or, yeah, you know, everybody's got different ways of making it
work. But see, exactly. But that's the sort of thing you need to learn about yourself, yes, in order to make it a successful business, which is why I suggest, you know, working for someone else when, you know, not when it's not your money and your livelihood on the line, initially, so you can figure out what, whether it will work for you at all, and what you need to, and what kinds of things work well and work, what don't, what you are good at and what you aren't, that kind of thing.
And also learning about your market in your particular area, because your market's going to be, exactly, different than our market, which is going to be different than Jean-Martin Fortier's market, which is going to be different than James Robinson's, sure, market, who's the one who told me about him. She's down in Kentucky. And are they having a tough year? I just, my heart broke for her. They had floods in Kentucky and lost like everything,
I saw,
practically their whole crop. So they rebounded a little, but nothing like they were planning. So you got to be ready for those years. And just like you were saying, you never know what's going to happen in the spring. We were like looking like, 2 weeks ago, it looked like you could start planning any day now. And then we got this huge storm. And like I said, it's 16 below today. So the weather in Montana, you never know when you're going to get a frost. I mean, like I said before, I could, if I have a basil plant out, it could die any day. I don't think there's a day of the year that we cannot get a frost in Montana. So you just never know. Okay, final question. If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, Gabe, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
I would say access to good food and food justice. A depressingly overwhelming percentage of the population does not have access to healthy foods, fresh fruits and vegetables. You know, because most of our population lives in cities, and in a lot of those cities you have what are called food deserts. And food deserts are places where, you know, there is not access to like good healthy food. All you have is fast food available. There are a number of different organizations that are trying to combat this. The one that I have the most experience with and know the most people working for is called Food For. And they're a subset of AmeriCorps, and they work to educate people in inner cities and in schools about, you know, what where their food comes from, how food is grown, what it takes to, you know, eat a healthy diet, And they're doing a lot for people because, you know, food, like, you know, food justice is not only an ethical and moral responsibility, but is but serves the greater public health and the public good. The better people eat, the better they live, the longer they live with fewer medical problems.
And it also nourishes their brains. I love this. And it's so true. And the food court people have been huge where I live. And this is hitting me like Mike laughed at me because I bought a bag of Fruit Loops for my students. But I looked at him and I'm like, okay, so here's $3 worth of broccoli. I would have to have two of these $3 bags of broccoli to keep my kids happy for one day. And they would eat that broccoli for sure. They keep asking me, when is Mr. Buyer going to have those purple beans again or some carrots? Because I brought a lot of that in the beginning of the year. But the Fruit Loops are going to last me a whole week, and that bag cost me $1.99. So, you know, I would love to be able to bring them broccoli, and that's not even organic broccoli, but or carrots or anything that they would eat. But the cost of food, I'm sorry, but just processed food at certain points is affordable. And just people cannot always. And I'm in the second highest paying district in the whole state. I mean, I'm on a federally very subsidized, you know, they pay us well, but it's a struggle. My paychecks, like, are not what I would like them to be, for sure. And
think about somebody who's living week to week, and, you know, what are they able to afford? What can they feed their children? And
I can't even imagine, you know, it.
Exactly. Some people have to make that, even for some people who have the knowledge and the wherewithal to say, this is unhealthy, but I need to stay alive, so this is what I'm able to afford. And that's the serious problem that faces our country, not just our country, the whole world.
It does. All right, so just quickly, do you have like an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden?
I do. I actually, my grandfather wrote this in his memoirs. He wrote a lot, but he wrote about gardening a lot as well. And he was much more eloquent than I was. So is it okay if I just read what he wrote?
Absolutely.
All right. When you become occupied in your garden with head and hands, your worries tend to disappear. I often find myself unable to recollect what was troubling me before I became engrossed in thought or labor or pleasure in one of my gardens. Further, one develops the self-discipline that comes with having to do things when it's time to do them. Planting can't be put off, neither can cultivating nor weeding. You learn to keep going when you'd much rather not, and to accept an occasional poor result at the end of the season despite your best efforts. You also learn to take justifiable pride when you walk around and see the ripening of your vegetables and the beauty of your flower beds. In short, for me, gardening is a metaphor for life from beginning to end.
Wow. Are his memoirs published? He sounds like the president.
No.
He could be a
president. No, they're not. He was a professor of psychology at Princeton University. So writing was his life's work. But his memoirs were never published. He wrote them for his grandchildren, and they're really fascinating. But he had them printed and bound for us.
Aww, that's awesome.
But yeah, if anybody's interested in his psychological work, he was an experimental psychologist. His name was Joseph Noderman, and his work's pretty easy to find.
Cool. Well, tell people how to connect with you, because this has been an awesome interview. Thank you so much, and I know it's probably going way longer than you thought.
No, I budgeted plenty of time for this, and like I said, I love talking about this kind of stuff. This is what I do. So, and you can reach me by calling me at my business phone at 609-477-2016. You can email me at abesacresfarm@gmail.com. That's abesacresfarm@gmail.com. Or you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, any of the social media sites. And if snail mail is your thing, my address is PO Box 973, Hightstown, New Jersey, zip code 08520. I love hearing from people. I love answering questions. And like I just told you, I love talking about this stuff.
Awesome. Well, you have an awesome day.
Thank you. Likewise.
Did you get your copy of the 2018 Spring Garden Journal? It's now live on Amazon for only $8.95. Since I took out January and February, it really dropped the price. It's a great place to record your garden journey, keep all your data in one place. You're going to want to remember frost dates, planting dates, seed varieties, harvest dates. And just so many of my guests have said that keeping good records have helped them be the most productive gardeners they can be. Mike and I created this journal to keep track of what you're growing, what you're eating, what you're harvesting, and just all those things together. So get your 2018 Spring Garden Journal today. If you know somebody who would benefit from the Organic Gardener podcast, we would just love it if you would share it with a friend. Thanks again for listening, and remember to grow.